everyone, by the way. It's great to see you all once more. If you were here in February, you may remember that we looked at the rise of nonconformity in the late 16th and early 17th centuries in response to the stalling of Reformation in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, which left the church, in their words, but halfly reformed. When James I became king, the pressure intensified to conform to unbiblical church practices and ceremonies. And godly people were faced with difficult choices. Do I stay or do I go? And over a period of nearly 50 years, people were engaged in much soul searching and many debates about what was the will of God, the right course of action to take. Varying views were expressed and different conclusions were reached. Last time, if you were here, we considered the response of Arthur Hildersham, minister at Ashby de la Zouche. And he represented those who decided to stay. And although his conscientious nonconformity led to heavy persecution from the church authorities, he still felt that he must stay within the Church of England, because it remained a true church as long as it had gospel preaching, despite the many corruptions in it. During a long preaching ban, he seriously thought about emigrating to Holland, but in the end he didn't go. He stayed put. Well, tonight we're going to examine the lives of two other men, Francis Higginson and John Cotton. Both of them were friends of Hildersham, and they were greatly influenced by him. And they took a different course of action, going. They didn't consider that they were separating from the Church of England, but they emigrated to escape the persecution that they were facing. You might have been expecting this, but tonight's lecture, in fact, is about this. Here, then, is an outline of the lecture. First of all, we're going to look about how the situation worsened from 1600 to the 1630s for the nonconformists. Then, we'll consider a brief history of earlier English North American colonization from the 1580s to the 1620s. That's really setting the background to tonight's lecture. Then, thirdly, we'll look at the life of Francis Higginson, 1586 to 1630, followed by the life, fourthly, of John Cotton, 1585 to 1652. And then a very brief conclusion, five lessons that I've learnt while preparing for the lecture. So, point one, the situation worsens, 1600 to the 1630s. I don't know if any of you have ever taken part in a high jump competition. Just when you've successfully cleared one height, the bar is raised and it keeps on going up and up until you can no longer get over it. And this is an illustration of how Bible-believing people in the Church of England felt at the beginning of the 17th century. In order to keep things going at a local level, they were perhaps prepared to make some pragmatic compromises, as long as the gospel was still being preached. However, under King James I and his son Charles I, the demands for conformity increased. The bar kept on being raised, you could say. And it became harder and harder to square what was happening in the church with their consciences and the word of God. There was a growing emphasis on ritual and ceremony, which to many smacked of Roman Catholicism. New worship ceremonies were introduced, such as bowing at the name of Jesus, which was a very Catholic practice. Communion tables were replaced by altars that were fenced off with altar rails, at which the people must kneel to receive communion, just as in the Catholic Mass. And along with this came a perceived attack on preaching itself, the very means that God had ordained for spreading the gospel. Sunday afternoon sermons were banned, as was preaching on any subject like predestination that was deemed controversial. And ministers were obliged to read from the Book of Sports, which was issued in 1618, to their congregations. And this book encouraged participation in sporting and leisure activities on Sundays once the morning service was over. God's people saw this as an attack on keeping the Lord's Day holy. Now, this picture is from a woodcut, and it shows a domineering bishop there in the middle, and he's saying only canonical prayers on the one side, prayers that were in the prayer book, and he's saying no afternoon sermons on the other side. And people felt that God was angry because of his preachers being silenced. And the image of preachers as extinguished lights became a common one. Well, this sense of being under attack from a resurgent Catholicism at home was reinforced by events in Europe. Catholic armies were defeating Protestant forces in Bohemia, the Palatinate, and France. Prince Charles, heir to the throne, married a Catholic French princess, Henrietta Maria. So the threat from popery, as they called it, seemed very real. When Charles I became king in 1625, things only got worse for the conformists and Calvinists in the Church of England. Charles, a weak but stubborn man, was heavily influenced not only by his Catholic wife, but also by the man that he appointed as Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud. Laud had already served as Bishop of London, and he was a man on a mission. Anti-Calvinistic in theology and high church in practice, he was determined to root out Puritanism from the Church of England and impose conformity upon it. Laud was much more efficient and thorough in his enforcement than previous archbishops, and places which had earlier provided havens for embattled nonconformists, such as lectureships and even English congregations in Holland, now came within the long reach of Laud. And if there was one single thing that caused emigration from England in the 1630s, it was the persecution of Archbishop Laud. And those areas of the country which suffered the fiercest Laudian persecution, such as London and East Anglia, saw the biggest numbers of people deciding to emigrate. But loyalty to the Church of England ran deep, as we saw in the case of Hildesheim. But in the late 1620s and 1630s, the screw was being tightened, and flight began to seem a more viable proposition for God's persecuted flock. They began to ask, was this the providence of God closing one door and opening another? Opinion was divided on this. Would going abroad be deserting their country and God's people at a time of their greatest need? Daniel Rogers, a minister from Wethersfield in Essex, who had been suspended by Laud in 1629, argued against emigration. Alas, he said, all cannot go. What will become of such as must stay? On the other hand, there was the precedent of those who had fled to the continent in the reign of Mary Tudor in the 1550s. But nobody wanted to be accused of schism or separating from the Church of England. But it wasn't just a selfish desire to be able to worship according to their consciences that drove nonconformists from England in their thousands in the 1630s, but a real sense that God was turning his back on the nation as a result of its disregard for the gospel. In 1635, Charles Chauncey, a minister from Ware in Hertfordshire, named his son Ichabod, the glory has departed, a reference to the capture of the Ark of the Covenant by the Philistines in 1 Samuel 4, verse 21. And Thomas Hooker, a Leicestershire man, born in Markfield and educated in Market Bosworth, who will feature in today's story, he famously declared, "England have seen her best days. As sure as God is God, God is going from England. God is packing up of his gospel because none will buy his wares." Hooker went on to warn that God begins to ship away his Noahs, which prophesied and foretold that destruction was near. And God makes account that New England shall be a refuge for his Noahs and his lots, a rock and a shelter for his righteous ones to run unto. This then is the background to what is known as the Great Migration of the 1630s, when it's calculated that between 13,000 and 21,000 people, men, women, children, whole families, emigrated to the New World in pursuit of liberty to worship according to their consciences and taking the gospel of Jesus Christ with them to another continent. Now to our second point, a brief history of English earlier colonization of North America. So these settlers who journeyed to New England in the 1630s were not the first people, English people, to colonize America. So let's just look briefly at some earlier ventures by way of background. Now the first one, you can see it with a ring round, was in 1585 in Roanoke in Virginia, what's now North Carolina. This was the brainchild of Sir Walter Raleigh, with a mission to challenge Spanish domination of the Americas and to develop lucrative trade with the region. The colony came to a bad end within a few years as the settlers mysteriously disappeared. But the familiar problems of sickness, climate, lack of supplies, and relations with the indigenous people, the Indians, these problems were already obvious in the struggle for Europeans to survive and establish any kind of settlement in the Americas. The second venture was in 1607 at Jamestown in Virginia, close to the modern city of Williamsburg. And the Virginia Company was granted a patent from King James to develop trading links here. After a tough start, a settlement managed to get established. And this is the colony associated with tobacco and Pocahontas. Thirdly, which one I'm sure you've heard of, the Pilgrim Fathers and New Plymouth. And in this venture, flight from religious persecution and freedom of worship were the major motivations. But unlike our main subjects tonight, these pilgrims were avowed separatists from the Church of England, who had on principle already formed themselves into separatist congregations prior to their emigration. Led by men like William Bradford, William Brewster, and Edward Winslow, they declared that they were, quotes, making haste out of Babylon as they left their native shores. They came from areas in Nottinghamshire, Yorkshire, and Lincolnshire, centred around the Lincolnshire village of Scrooby. First, they went to Holland in 1608, and then they sailed to the New World aboard the Mayflower in 1620, settling in a place that they named Plymouth. Well, separatism is the subject of our next lecture, so I won't say any more about them now. But the distinction between them and the later settlers is an important one, even if in practice in New England these distinctions became somewhat blurred, as we shall see. And both Bradford and Winslow wrote journals of their experiences in the New World, which were eagerly received back home and helped to plant the idea of America as a possible place of settlement in people's minds. Also, the practical advice that they gave on how to survive became an invaluable resource for any potential new settlers. And then, fourthly, 1629 to 1640, the Great Migration to Massachusetts. And tonight's subjects, Higginson and Cotton, were part of this Great Migration, which was on a different scale to any of the earlier attempts. The earlier colonies were in hundreds, this was in thousands. And it's a vast subject about which many words have been written on both sides of the Atlantic. And I can hope to do no more than introduce the subject to you through the lives of these two men. So, thirdly, Francis Higginson, 1586 to 1630. Who was he, and how did he end up in America? Well, Francis Higginson was born in the village of Claybrook in Leicestershire, just down the A5 from where we live in Hinckley, on the borders with Warwickshire. He was the son of the local vicar, John Higginson, and he was baptised in Claybrook on the 6th of August, 1586, or possibly 1587. He went up to Cambridge University in 1602, attending first St John's College and then Jesus College, finally gaining his MA in 1613. After ordination as a minister in 1614, he became vicar of Claybrook, in succession to his father. On the 8th of January 1616, he married Anne Herbert at St Peter's Church in Nottingham, and they went on to have 9 children. So far, this seems a pretty standard CV for the time, and nothing in it indicates how his life was going to diverge from that normal pattern. Up to 1615, he was a strict conformist, and the expectations were that he would have gone on to follow a comfortable career as vicar at Claybrook, perhaps for the rest of his ministry. So what happened to change the course of his life? The answer is that in the providence of God, he became acquainted with 2 esteemed Leicestershire preachers. One was the older Arthur Hildersham of Ashby, and the other was his contemporary, Thomas Hooker, from Markfield, both of them convinced nonconformists. Under their influence, he studied the scriptures, and he became more and more dissatisfied with the rituals and the ceremonies that men had introduced into the worship of God. And with the evidence of the scriptures before him, he too became a ceremonial nonconformist. Within Leicestershire, Higginson had already gained a reputation as an evangelical preacher, and great crowds flocked to hear him preach in Claybrook, in the village of Belgrave, and in Leicester itself. It's reported that the great object of his ministry was, quotes, to produce that change of heart and holy rectitude of conduct without which no man can see the Lord. God blessed his ministry with much fruit. And with the toleration of the local Bishop of Lincoln, John Williams, Francis was able to carry on for a number of years, preaching in different churches, despite his nonconformity. The mayor and the aldermen of Leicester chose Higginson to be the city preacher. But he declined the offer and other similar invitations because he could not, with a good conscience, conform. He managed to support himself and his family by tutoring young ministerial candidates who were bound for the university. However, from 1627 onwards, Higginson came to the attention of William Laud, at that time Bishop of London, and in 1628 complaints against him were lodged in the High Commission Court. Higginson lived in daily expectation that he too that he would be seized by court officials, with imprisonment and all too real prospect. So when two men came knocking loudly at his door, crying, "Where is Mr. Higginson? We must speak with Mr. Higginson." His terrified wife naturally assumed they'd come to arrest him, and she begged him to hide himself upstairs. But Francis's response was that the will of God must be done, and that he would go down and speak to the men. When he did so, the men roughly pressed papers into his hand and declared they'd come to carry him up to London. "I thought so," cried Higginson's weeping wife. But when Higginson looked at the papers, he saw not an arrest warrant, but an invitation to serve as a minister in New England from the governor of the recently formed Massachusetts Bay Company, who had heard of his plight. However, the messengers sent to deliver the letter thought it would be fun to play a trick on Higginson by pretending that they'd come to arrest him. And it doesn't sound like a very funny trick to me. By this stage, Higginson had already discussed the possibility of emigration with his mentor, Arthur Hildersham, who had advised him, "Were I a younger man and under your case and call, I would think I had a plain invitation of heaven unto the voyage." So when the letter came, Higginson took it as a call from God, and after much prayer, resolved to accept. Higginson preached his farewell sermon before a large congregation in Leicester, his text being Luke 21, verses 20 to 21. "When ye see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them that are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out." Higginson's forecast that England would soon be chastised by war, and that Leicester in particular would suffer, came true in 1645 in the Civil War, when Leicester was brutally besieged by royalist forces. Higginson thanked all those who had shown him favour and told them that he was going to New England, which he believed God had designed as a refuge for persecuted nonconformists. And when he left the city, the streets were lined with weeping people bidding him farewell. Well, coming from landlocked Leicestershire, Higginson had never sailed before. Probably he'd never even seen the sea. With his wife and family, 8 children aged between 2 and 14, Higginson sailed aboard the Talbot from Gravesend on the 25th of April, 1629. And it took them 45 days from leaving the Isle of Wight to their arrival in Salem Harbour, which they did arrive at on the 29th of June. As the ship passed Land's End, Higginson is said to have called his children and other passengers up on deck for a final look at the land of their birth, saying, "We will not say, as the separatists are wont to say at their leaving of England, farewell Babylon, farewell Rome, but we will say, farewell, dear England. Farewell the Church of God in England and all the Christian friends there. We do not go to New England as separatists from the Church of England, though we cannot but separate from the corruptions in it. But we go to practice the positive part of church reformation and propagate the gospel in America." And he concluded with a prayer for the king, state, and church in England, and for the presence and blessing of God in their present undertaking. Also aboard the Talbot was Samuel Skelton, a nonconformist minister from Lincolnshire, and the two men would serve together in the church at Salem. Higginson kept a journal of the voyage, which was sent back to London in August 1629. And in it, he describes the amazing new sights he sees, like whales and icebergs, and the grim realities of life at sea, such as storms and sickness. But throughout the crossing, Sunday worship and daily prayer were faithfully observed. Higginson describes the five ships in the fleet, well armed because of the threat of piracy. Aboard were about 350 passengers, 12 months' provisions, and domestic animals, cows, goats, and horses. On Sunday the 17th of May, Francis relates how two of his children, Samuel, aged 9, and Mary, 4, fell sick of smallpox, which had been brought aboard by one of the passengers. 2 days later, Francis records, "My daughter grew sicker, and many blue spots were seen on her breast, which affrighted us. At first, we thought they had been the plague tokens, but we found afterwards that it was only a high measure of the infection of the pox, which was struck again into the child. And so it was, God's will, the 19th of May, 1629, the child died about 5 o'clock at night, being the first in the ship that was buried in the bowels of the great Atlantic Sea." Higginson explains that since she was very young, Mary had suffered greatly with back, joint, and abdominal pains. And so he concluded, despite her parents' grief, "In respect of her, we had cause to take her death as a mercy and blessing from the Lord to shorten her misery." Her death was followed by a day of solemn fasting and prayer. And 2 days later, young Samuel began to recover. On Wednesday, the 27th of May, they were hit by a terrible storm, throughout which Francis lay anxiously in his cabin, unable to sleep. He meditated on Psalm 107, verses 23 to 32, which John read at the beginning, and this helped to calm his fears. On Friday, the 19th of June, the American coast was spotted, and by June the 25th, they had clear sight of many islands, hills, and woods by the seashore. And after a few days in harbour, on Tuesday the 30th of June, John Endicott, the colony's governor, who had arrived with an advance party a few months earlier, came aboard and welcomed them to America. What did they find when they finally got there? Knowing that those back in England would be eager to hear news, soon after his arrival, Higginson wrote a long letter to some friends in Leicester, telling them all about his first impressions of the new colony. And his letter was published in 1630 as a popular pamphlet entitled New England's Plantation. In it, Francis describes how, on arrival, they found about 10 houses already constructed. Now, this isn't actually one of the original ones, but a replica of the village and the settlers' houses has been constructed at Salem, so you could visit it today. So that he found 10 of these houses and a larger house made for the governor, and also an abundance of corn planted by the first group of settlers. The native name of the place, Nehemkek, have to excuse my pronunciation, they changed to Salem from Psalm 76, verse 2, which says, "In Salem also is his God's tabernacle and his dwelling place in Zion." And this change of name demonstrated their clear intentions to found a settlement where God and his glory was central. In the 1690s, of course, Salem was notorious for its witch trials, but that's later than the events we're dealing with tonight. So a community of about 200 was formed at Salem, while about 100 others set off to plant a town we call Charlestown, Charleston. "We at Salem," he reported, "make haste to build houses. Soon we will have a fair town." He then gives a glowing description of the climate, the soil, the natural resources, etc., of his new home. In particular, he found the air very health-giving, and he related how his own health, which had always been so poor back in England, was so much improved that he was even able to leave off his cap that he'd previously worn at all times. He was wearing it on that picture that we saw. And he concluded that, A sup of New England air is better than a whole draught of Old England's ale. He details the religion and lifestyle of the native inhabitants of the land, saying, "We use them kindly. We purpose to learn their language as soon as we can, which will be a means to do them good," meaning, of course, to share the gospel with them. The settlers were well equipped to defend themselves should they face a hostile enemy attack. But, he declares, "that which is our greatest comfort and means of defence above all other is that we have here the true religion and holy ordinances of Almighty God taught amongst us. Thanks be to God, we have here plenty of preaching and diligent catechising, and good and commendable orders to bring our people into a Christian conversation. And thus we doubt not that God will be with us. And if God be with us, who can be against us?" Well, after 12 pages of positives, Higginson only has 4 negative points. And even these, he stresses, are not insuperable. They are: 1, mosquitoes in summer; 2, much snow and frost in winter; 3, rattlesnakes; and 4, a lack of good, honest Christians bringing with them horses, cows, and sheep to make use of this fruitful land. And then he finishes with a catalogue of things every planter needed to bring with him or her in order to survive in New England. Of course, Higginson hoped that his descriptions of New England would encourage others to join them, so he certainly emphasises the positive features. Things almost sound too good to be true, but he stresses that he is giving an honest picture of the conditions. In the light of subsequent experience, his first impressions seem a little bit over-optimistic. Higginson and Samuel Skelton, as the first ministers to arrive in the new colony, began conducting services immediately they landed in Salem. You might recall Higginson's emphatic declaration on leaving England that they were not separatists and continued to be in fellowship with the Church of England. However, once in Salem, they discovered that Governor Endicott had already been in contact with William Bradford, one of the leaders of the separatist Plymouth colony just down the coast, and that the majority of people in Salem were similarly following a congregational form of church worship and government. Higginson and Skelton soon came to accept this system as the most practical way of doing things and consistent with their own reading of the scriptures. They denied that they were separating from the Church of England, but clearly they began to lay out the principles of congregationalism. So when the church at Salem was officially formed in August 1629, it was on this basis. So what did congregationalism consist of in practice? Well, after fasting and prayer, about 30 people as a company of believers covenanted together to walk together in all the ways of God. Higginson was desired to draw up a confession of faith and covenant in scripture language, which being done was agreed upon. Anyone wishing to join the church was required to give a testimony to their faith and spiritual experience in front of the elders and the congregation prior to being accepted into membership. When Samuel Skelton was chosen as the pastor and Francis Higginson as his assistant, it was by a free vote of every member. And only members could have their children baptized or receive communion. And at Salem, they no longer used the English prayer book in their worship. And this led to 2 members of the new congregation, the Brown brothers, who wanted episcopal government by bishops. They made complaints to the governors of the company back in England that the 2 ministers were separating from the Church of England. And Higginson wrote to justify his and Skelton's actions, protesting that, quotes, they were neither separatists nor Anabaptists. They did not separate from the Church of England, nor from the ordinances of God there, but only from the corruptions and disorders there. And that they came away from the Book of Common Prayer and ceremonies and had suffered much for their nonconformity in their native land. And therefore, being in a place where they might have their liberty, they neither could or would use them, because they judged the imposition of these things to be sinful corruption in the worship of God. The company governors ruled in favour of Skelton and Higginson in this dispute, and the Brown brothers were ordered to return to England. It was the first of many disagreements that were to arise as the settlers endeavoured to set up churches. Arthur Hildersham had advised the company to sort out the details of a religious settlement before they went, and it might have helped if they had taken his advice. Well, Higginson's improved health and hopes for an active ministry in New England were soon sadly dashed. About 100 of his congregation, between a third and a half, died of sickness during the first harsh winter in Salem. And by the summer of 1630, he too had succumbed to the fever, less than a year after his arrival. And when the Winthrop fleet, with its new influx of settlers, arrived, he was too weak to go down to the harbour to welcome them. He was able to deliver a final sermon on the text of Matthew 11, verse 7, "What went she out into the wilderness to see?" in which he emphasised that the chief purpose of the plantation was the promotion of true religion, that various trials were to be expected in a new country, and that the settlers should work together in unity. Confined to his bed, Francis was visited by the chief people of the colony, who lamented that they were about to lose him, and praised his part in laying the foundation of, quotes, church reformation in America. But he answered, "I have been but an unprofitable servant. All my desire is to win Christ and be found in him, not having my own righteousness." He expressed his strong belief that God would raise up others to carry on the work and commended the care of his wife and children into the hands of his brethren. And he died on the 6th of August, 1630, aged 43, and was buried in Salem. His wife survived him by about 10 years, continued to live in the colony. Their eldest son, John, followed his father into the ministry in New England, and another son, Francis, returned to England, entering the Church of England ministry as vicar of Kirkby Stephen in Westmoreland. And as one of the first wave of settlers, Higginson was a true pioneer. He was a man of great faith, trusting God as he stepped out into the unknown wilderness. And later, the covenant and confession drawn up by Francis Higginson for the church in Salem was substantially that adopted by the Congregational Churches of England in 1658 as the Savoy Declaration. Now on to our fourth point. We'll move on to the life of John Cotton, 1585 to 1652, who was one of the major figures in the early spiritual history of New England. Francis Higginson died 3 years before Cotton arrived in America. But Cotton went on to play a very significant part in the next 20 years of the developing colony. When he landed in America, aged 48, he had already got an established reputation as a biblical scholar. He was called a walking library. He was a powerful preacher and a leader of God's people. Well, John Cotton was born in Derby, we'll have to forgive him that, on the 4th of December 1585. He was the son of a lawyer, Roland Cotton, and his wife, Mary. And after studying at Derby Grammar School, he became a student at Trinity College, Cambridge, in 1598, when he was 13. gaining his BA in 1603, then moving to Emmanuel College, the great Puritan foundation, where he graduated MA in 1606. And he accepted a fellowship at Emmanuel College, and over the next 6 years, he served as head lecturer and dean of the college. And during most of these 6 years, Thomas Hooker from Leicestershire, of whom we have already heard because of his influence on Higginson, he was also a fellow of Emmanuel. While Cotton was still in his teens, he came under conviction of sin through the sermons of the great Puritan preacher William Perkins. But it was through the preaching of another minister, Richard Phipps, that Cotton was finally led to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. Cotton was ordained as a minister when he was 25 in 1610. And at first, his preaching was noted for its learned and ornate style. But then, following Sibb's example, he began to preach in a plainer and more direct style. And Cotton's plain preaching was instrumental in the conversion of John Preston, at that time a fellow of Queen's College and later Master of Emmanuel. And between Cotton and Preston, a great friendship and partnership in the gospel developed. In 1612, Cotton left Cambridge to become vicar of St. Botolph's Church in Boston in Lincolnshire. And hearing that Cotton was the finest preacher in Cambridge, he'd been headhunted by the church leaders of that town, which had a strong Puritan contingent. Now, I don't know if any of you have visited Boston. Two people. Good. Some more might visit after this. Well, we visited it recently when I was beginning to research this lecture. And it's a fascinating place with a rich history. But you almost get a feeling that its best days are behind it. In fact, the guidebook, its own guidebook, says that its power and wealth, which is due mainly to its huge trade in sheep fleeces, peaked in the medieval period, about 1389, and it's been downhill all the way since. However, its massive church, which is the second largest parish church in England, known as the Stump, the Boston Stump, still dominates the town. And you can see the very pulpit where Cotton preached. The stairs have been new since the 18th century, but that is the pulpit in which he preached. There's also a stained glass window that's been put up more recently, commemorating him and those that went to New England. And in the churchyard, there's a Puritan path, some stones laid out. And in the Guildhall, you can see the cells where some of the Mayflower pilgrims were held before their flight to Holland in 1608. So you can see I'm under commission from the Boston Tourist Board. However, I must warn you that if you're thinking of going, the church is currently undergoing major repairs. You can't get into lots of it. And the style and content of worship are evidently very different from those of Cotton's day. Well, soon after his move to Boston, Cotton married Elizabeth Horrocks, who was the sister of a Lancashire preacher. For many years, he'd struggled with assurance of his salvation. But on the very day of his wedding to Elizabeth, Cotton received that assurance, often saying afterwards, "The Lord made that day a day of double marriage." John and Elizabeth's marriage of 18 years was a close one, but they were childless. At St. Botolph's, Cotton had a powerful ministry for almost 20 years, attracting great crowds from the surrounding countryside. In addition to Sunday sermons, Cotton preached in the early morning on Thursdays and Fridays and on Saturday afternoons. A lady called Anne Hutchinson was one person who travelled 24 miles on many occasions to feast on his sermons and later followed him to the New World. He preached the law as he addressed unconverted sinners, but he was noted for his emphasis on God's love and grace to believers. And when he expounded 1 John, he spoke of the imperfections of the Church of England, but he was far more critical of separatism. Many of the leading figures in the town, the mayor and the aldermen, were great supporters of Cotton's preaching, and they rallied to his defence when he was targeted for his ceremonial nonconformity, helping to get his suspensions lifted in 1615 and again in 1621. And Cotton also cultivated relationships with his diocesan bishops, especially John Williams, who was a favourite of James I. And Cotton always wrote to them in a respectful and diplomatic manner, stressing his loyalty to the Church of England. And this too shielded him for a long time from the worst effects of his nonconformity. Cotton also had a wider ministry, serving as a pastor to pastors. He trained young men for the ministry in his household seminary, many sent from Emmanuel College by John Preston. And he was a renowned letter writer, following the example of the Apostle Paul. And as a correspondent, he earned a reputation as a helpful advisor to embattled or confused Puritan clergy during the troubled years of the 1610s and 1620s. Cotton's first biographer wrote, "He answered many letters that were sent from far and near, wherein were handled many difficult cases of conscience, and many doubts by him cleared to the greatest satisfaction." But by the end of the 1620s, Cotton was finding it increasingly difficult to ward off demands for his conformity. He began to reconsider his choices. Again, should I stay or should I go? He was a friend of some of those promoting the Massachusetts Bay Company. And in April 1630, he journeyed to Southampton to deliver a farewell sermon to 400 emigrating settlers of the Winthrop fleet. Many of these settlers came from Cotton's own church in Boston, so he knew them personally, and you can see their names commemorated on the stones of the Puritan path outside St. Botolph's Church. And these settlers went on to found Boston, New England, hence its name. But at that time, Cotton wasn't prepared to leave England himself. It was a hard choice for men of his generation to take. But circumstances changed. Both John and his wife went down with a serious attack of malaria, resulting in Elizabeth's death in April 1631. A year later, John married the widowed Sarah Story. And soon after their marriage in 1632, the couple were separated because John was forced into hiding to avoid prosecution for nonconformity. He'd been cited to appear before the High Commission Court, and he knew that conviction would lead to a lengthy prison sentence because of his prominence. During this time, Cotton took the opportunity to seek the advice of the veteran nonconformist minister, John Dodd. He was about 84 at this time, in Northamptonshire. And Dodd told him, quotes, "I am old and therefore must stand still and bear the brunt. But you, being young," I suppose 48 was young to him, "may go whither you will, and ought, being persecuted in one city, to flee unto another." Shortly after this, Cotton and his old Emmanuel friend Thomas Hooker, who'd already spent time in exile in Holland and likewise was under attack for his nonconformity, they took part in a secret conference in Surrey about how far it was right to conform to the ceremonies. And all but one of the godly ministers present at that conference eventually left for the Netherlands or New England. Cotton resigned his Boston living in May 1633, and on the 13th of July sailed for New England aboard the Griffin along with Thomas Hooker. On the voyage, Sarah gave birth to their first child, a son, who appropriately they named Seaborn. And we saw Higginson having a death of a child here as a birth of a child on board ship. And Cotton later wrote that he'd come to the decision to emigrate because, quotes, by the free preaching of the word and the actual practice of our church discipline, we could offer a much clearer and fuller witness in another land than in the wretched and loathsome prisons of London, where there would be no opportunity for books or pens or friends or conferences. He always remained sensitive, however, to the charge that he'd abandoned his parishioners and the community of saints in England. Soon after his arrival in Massachusetts, Cotton began to play a major role in the life of the colony. A contemporary wrote that Skelton and Higginson walked something in an untrodden path in the early years. But when Cotton and Hooker arrived in 1633, they, quote, did clear up the order and method of church government, according as they apprehended was most consonant to the word of God. And such was the authority they, especially Mr. Cotton, had in the hearts of the people, that whatever he delivered in the pulpit was soon put into an order of court, if of a civil matter, or set up as a practice in the church, if of an ecclesiastical concernment. While still in Lincolnshire, in October 1630, Cotton had written a censorious letter to Samuel Skelton, criticising the practice of the Salem Church for seeming to follow the separatist lead of the Plymouth congregation. Cotton had pleaded, "Till Christ give us a bill of divorcement, do not divorce yourself from us." Ministers who remained in England tended to see the practice of the New England churches as too exclusive, especially in terms of admission to membership and administration of the sacraments. But when he actually got to New England, Cotton's views took a 180-degree turn. He not only changed his mind about the practice of requiring a full confession of faith from each aspiring member, regardless of their previous church affiliations, but he became a leading promoter of it. But he still insisted that the Massachusetts Bay clergy were not separatists, but remained firmly in fellowship with the Church of England. And this is illustrated by the fact that most of the colonists who returned to England, either on a visit or permanently, worshipped in the parish churches, not in separatist congregations. Well, John and Sarah were admitted to the Boston, Massachusetts Church on the 8th of September, 1633, and they presented their son, Seaborn, for baptism. At a fast held on the 10th of October, 1633, Cotton was invited to join John Wilson in the ministry of the church. There were many blessings in these early years. It was reported that as a result of Cotton's preaching, more were converted and added to that church and to all the other churches in the Bay. And records show that in the 4 months following Cotton's arrival, membership of the Boston Church grew from 80 to 124, with 93 additional men and women joining in 1634. Well, this success, his reputation in England, and his location in the colony's foremost church quickly established him as one of the leading ministers in the colony. Cotton also continued to work for the reform of the Church of England through correspondence with friends in England and exiles in the Netherlands. In civil matters, he was influential as an advisor to the governor and the magistrates of the Bay Colony as they sought to set up laws to govern daily life. So God was obviously blessing Cotton and his ministry. Everything seemed rosy in the garden, you might think. However, we must remember that the settlers had only gone to America, not to heaven. They were still sinful men and women, still prone to attacks and temptations from the evil one. In a new situation, the pioneers had to work everything out from scratch, and there were bound to be teething problems and mistakes as they went along. Even the godliest people sometimes get things wrong. It's impossible to go into detail about all the challenges that John Cotton faced. I'm just going to flag up a few of the areas of contention. The first of these was separatism. Throughout, as we've seen, he had to deal with accusations from those back home that he was separating from the Church of England. Secondly, liberty of conscience. And Cotton was criticised by a pastor called Roger Williams for not allowing liberty of conscience to believers who held different opinions to him. And Cotton argued that unity, if not uniformity, was vital for the survival of the churches in the colony. And modern commentators have tended to favour Williams' views over Cotton's, but perhaps not given enough weight to the historical context in which they were aired. And Williams also attacked Cotton for not separating enough from the Church of England. He favoured separatism, so he was criticised on both sides. And a book on Cotton called The Subversive Puritan by Mostyn Roberts has just been published by Evangelical Press in the last couple of weeks, so I haven't actually had time to read it. Thirdly, the Antinomian controversy of 1636 to 1638. And since New Testament times, there has been discussion about the place of grace and the place of law in the Christian faith. If a law is emphasized too much, the church ends up in an unbiblical legalism. But on the other hand, if grace is preached exclusively with no reference to our obligation to lead holy lives, the result is antinomianism, which means against or without the law. And in that situation, anything goes. And at different times in its history, the church has leant more to one way and then the other. In England, Cotton's emphasis on grace in his preaching had already been noted. And in New England, he became embroiled in a crisis that threatened his very future in the colony, which became known as the Antinomian controversy. To put it very simply, it revolved around the covenants of works and grace. Was the evidence of sanctification in a person to be looked for in the external fruit they produced in their lives, or rather in an internal work of the Spirit? The widespread Puritan view was that good works were the necessary proof of a changed life, whereas Cotton seemed to be playing this down with his stress on a spiritual work in the heart. Or so it was alleged by a group of people led by Anne Hutchinson, previously part of Cotton's Lincolnshire congregation. And these people were going around propagating extreme views on this subject, which they said were Cotton's views, but in fact were a radical extension of what he had taught. Cotton was taken to task by Thomas Shepherd and a majority of the other colonial ministers who doubted Cotton's own orthodoxy. Now, at a synod in August 1637, Cotton was required to answer a set of questions designed to clarify his views and discover if he was indeed the source of Hutchinson's teachings. Cotton was forced to humble himself and admit his naivety in not realizing how his teaching could be interpreted, as well as distancing himself from the faction. Anne Hutchinson herself was found guilty and exiled from Boston. Afterwards, this awful time was recalled. Quotes, "Satan in short time stirred up strifes and dissensions to the great disturbance of the churches and of the country, which God at last mercifully quieted." As a result of this episode, Cotton was never quite the same again, being much more guarded in his expression. And temporarily, he lost much of his stature in the church. However, his reputation did recover, and he contributed much in his remaining years in the following four areas. One, as a correspondent and supporter of Oliver Cromwell during the Civil War years. Cromwell wrote to his esteemed friend, Mr. Cotton, in October 1651, prior to his decisive victory at Worcester. Quotes, "We need your prayers in this as much as ever. How shall we behave ourselves after such mercies? What is the Lord doing? What prophecies are now fulfilling? Who is a God like ours? To know his will, to do his will, are both of him." Secondly, as a spokesman for Congregationalism. Cotton was asked to return to England to speak at the Westminster Assembly of Divines. He didn't go, but he did send written advice, and he also published several books explaining and defending the congregational way. The third area was in 1639-40, and Cotton preached on the coming of the millennium in a series of lectures on the Book of Revelation, stressing the need for New England to remain true to its covenant with God as the last days approached. These sermons were later published and they became very popular in England as Puritans tried to make sense of the civil war in which they had become immersed in the 1640s. And fourthly, as an overseer of Harvard College, which was set up in 1636 for the training of young men for the ministry in America. But there were sadnesses during these years too, with the death of two of his six children, Sarah, aged 14, and Roland, aged 5, in a smallpox epidemic in 1650. Well, in December 1652, Cotton was taken ill after a preaching trip. He died a few days later, aged 67. He said that his desire was to depart so that he might enjoy Christ and the company of glorified saints, particularly his old friends, John Preston, Arthur Hildersham, John Dodd, and others, who'd been especially dear to him while he lived. And he was buried in Boston. His wife Sarah survived him for 24 years, marrying another pastor, Richard Mather, in 1656. Cotton was greatly mourned by his contemporaries, and his memory was kept alive by his successor as Boston minister, John Norton, who wrote Cotton's biography in 1658, and by the writings of his grandson, Cotton Mather. Well, John Cotton was, along with John Davenport and Thomas Hooker, who is credited as being the founding father of Connecticut, the most widely known and respected of the first generation of colonial clergy. And both Cotton and Francis Higginson are deservedly counted among the founding fathers of Congregationalism. So, by way of conclusion, and finally, five lessons I've learned from studying this subject, apart, that is, from learning to spell Massachusetts. One, when God closes one door, he opens another. Persecution in England led to the evangelization of America. Cotton reminded a silenced preacher of Revelation 3, verse 8, that God is able again to set before you an open door. There hasn't been time tonight to speak about one of their colleagues, John Eliot, commonly referred to as the Apostle to the Indians, and his work among the native people, but it's a fantastic story that deserves its own lecture. Secondly, it's always wise to seek advice from more mature believers and church elders before taking any momentous decision which potentially may change the course of our lives. Francis Higginson sought advice from Hildersham. John Cotton did the same with John Dodd before both set sail for America. Thirdly, things will not be perfect for us as believers until we reach heaven. Jesus promised us that in this world we will have tribulation. So we may think we're escaping our troubles when we move to a new place, but we can be sure there will be others waiting for us when we arrive. The fourth point, which is a question really. Where are the prophetic voices speaking to our nation and generation today about God's anger against our rejection of him and the need for repentance? This warning was sounded clearly in the 17th century. Is it being heard today? And fifthly, sometimes, like those early American settlers, we're required to take a tremendous step of faith into the unknown. But like them, we can trust implicitly in the loving faithfulness of God who goes before us in every step of our earthly pilgrimage. And to reiterate the words of Francis Higginson, we doubt not, but God will be with us. And if God be with us, who can be against us? If you want a copy of those 5 points, I've made some that are on the back table. So please join us again for the final instalment of the early nonconformist story in September, when we'll look at those who separated. Thank you.